Hey everyone, thank you so much for joining the Behind Company Lines podcast. I'm here today with Aaron Jin, CEO and co-founder of HydroHost. HydroHost specializes in providing data centers with the unparalleled provisioning, management, and security solutions, allowing them to focus on their core competency, hardware, and infrastructure. Aaron, I'm so excited to chat with you, not only discussing all of what you've done in your career in terms of growth and thinking about how you've been able to not only be a part of companies, scaling companies, but also being kind of within the tech ecosystem, and also what you're doing at HydroHost, which is, I think, extremely valuable as data becomes so much more important and even that much more challenging to make sure that we're storing it in the right location, that those centers are managing the information well, it's secure, and all that's incorporated with functioning and making good product that I think the end user, we don't appreciate as much. So before we get into all that with HydroHost, what were you doing before you started the company?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. So what I was doing for HydroHost, this is my fourth company with my co-founder. So I've done four companies with my co-founder, Garrett. And this is my second company with my other co-founder, Oriol. So we've been doing various types of building companies, projects, everything from creating like a think tank, actually in DC. It's the most prominent think tank for our views on technology in DC now, to building services business. I think that there's a strong bias towards like the only type of company you can build is one that take investor money. And that is not the case. And I can tell you from doing three that are not investor based. Before that, I'm most known for running product and technology at a company called Everlane, which is a billion-dollar fashion company. And then Garrett started a company that went through ICV and sold that. I was in the sort of SaaS teleco space. And then Oriol was actually, he's the youngest of all of us. He actually was going to University of Miami for finance, then learned how to code and then dropped out of college. That's when he started working with us. So I've been kind of doing startups for over a decade. First was like healthcare and then into like e-com, social media, and then had some touching into politics and then came back and, you know, met up with Garrett and then we started doing companies since then.
Yeah. And what in particular was the common thread between those companies? Were you looking to solve a particular problem? Were you interested in a certain experience that people were having and trying to solve it in different industries? What in particular do you think was the common thread for why you chose to work on those projects, being that they were different, healthcare to fashion to all these different things?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a little bit of over complexity when founders are thinking about what they want to do and why they want to do it. Yeah. I think most of the stuff you hear from successful entrepreneurs is actually like hubris. It's something that they sort of post hoc, ergo proctor hoc, after the fact analysis like, oh, I'm going to justify something because I am successful. When there's kind of a bit of more of a wandering that happens, I think, for successful entrepreneurs, that they find something that's interesting to them and they just kind of pursue it and then they kind of see what happens. So I treat it more as like an expression of like art or discovery that I'm showcasing something about my personality or my interests. And then we kind of build the team around that and then we kind of pursue it. So the decision that we made between Garrett and I am lucky to have done four companies with the same co-founder. And I think that that's rare in this world. But having a co-founder as another investor will tell you, it's like a second marriage, right?
Yeah.
And when you find somebody you can work with that is flexible and just knows what you're good at, what they're good at, what you're bad at, et cetera, and you just kind of do stuff together because of the innate built-in trust, it's something that's kind of magical and you can't really replace it. So we've done stuff that Garrett was very passionate about. I've done stuff that I've been very passionate about. But one of the things that I think is really critical for successful companies is that founder relationship. Because it does define the culture, success of the company, how you resolve problems, what you want to work on. And we've just always been consistent on like, we are good at certain things, bad at certain things as founders, but we both like enjoy working together. And we both use our capabilities and strengths to build different companies and products out of that. And so we've kind of taken more of a discovery approach, like that as we build things come up and other demands from customers, other needs from customers. And then from there, we then built the company. So the act of building a company is much more fun for me than the actual subject area. And I think that founders can get really obsessed around like the founding idea in the moment, when in reality, that's going to change. And because you can look at any real successful company that has like kind of defined a segment, what they started out with was very different than what they ended up becoming.
Yeah, it's the adaptation, the evolution. And thinking about, obviously, just tapping into your experience, thinking about how you've seen that at different types of companies, is there something that, you know, and you've worked at a lot of growth, which I obviously want to touch on in terms of what that involvement means and what growth actually means at different companies and where's the focus and things like that. But how does kind of the inner workings of companies kind of change as the product changes? And what are some ways that you've seen companies be really successful at defining their product and scaling their customer base? And what if you've seen at companies that maybe have missed the mark a little bit or could have hit it a little bit more? Anything that in particular that stood out?
Yeah, like I'm definitely strongest at like the 0 to 1 step. So developing a team, creating the vision, pushing like let's say an individual scrum team. So that typically, an active scrum team typically is 10 people, right? 12 people. So like that's like where I'm really strong at is organizing that idea, creating the momentum, finding the initial team, making them excited. Garrett is much stronger at the next step, which is like where you're starting to, as it enter in to like different levels of execs and management. I would say that's probably the hardest part of any company is moving from where you're a small agile team, you can talk to everyone every day, everyone knows what they're working on, to the next page, which really took like 20-ish, when you start building out management and start building out like directors and other execs, right?
Right.
That's a very hard thing to move from. And so like I'm just much more of an agile, like less process, and building out a company is like the difference between like having a project, which is where I'm kind of stronger in, like the initial startup phase, initial idea, to a company is actually really different. It's kind of the difference between maybe like a small business, an expression of a project, to actually building a company. And those are not the same thing, because you eventually have to move to the zone where you're no longer an IC, right? And that starts really fast. It must start much faster than you think as a startup founder. Like really like C plus to like A is like when you start getting to that moment in that raise is when you actually move away from being IC. And if you can't move away from being IC, you actually are not going to be a successful company. You're not going to be a successful startup. Everybody knows about an exec, a startup founder who is really good from that 1 to 12 range. And then they start scaling the company into the hundreds. And they have that founder that never was able to scale into management, aka stop doing IC work. And they just kind of sit in the corner and do stuff, right? But they have a title, but they don't really have management skills. They don't really, and they're just kind of there, right? And I think that as like a founding team, you always have to be cognizant of like the flexibility of like, okay, I'm not going to be good at that. And I need somebody else to do this for me. Like one helpful thing is like you can create like a list of things that, in order of things that you don't want to do. And then you basically make that then the hiring sheet, right? Of like, I'm not good at this, I'm not good at this, I'm not good at this, right? And that's a way of you can sort of move yourself into actual management and actual like building a company. But if you still remain in an IC role, it's hard to say that is that actually a company or like a project, right?
Right.
Because a company is scale, it's multiple operations, multiple, like it's basically seizing the moment to actually become a operation that can be 100 person operation, a couple hundred thousand, something like that. And you can't do that if you remain in the IC space.
Yeah.
Your role changes. And so you got to have other co-founders and other management that can come in and take those parts that you're not good at and scale with the organization. But it's hard. It's hard to like walk away from being an IC when you, like I find a ton of joy being an IC, but you know, you have to kind of seize the moment and actually scale with what the team needs.
Thinking about your contribution, especially as an early founder, and thinking about the contribution of a lot of early founders, finding product market fit and then identifying your ICP, your ideal customer profile, describe the process and how you think about it, being that I hear this word growth a lot. And from what I understand, obviously correct me if I'm wrong, but it's different ways to either grow one part of the business, whether it's a customer set, whether it's your brand, whether it's your marketing engine, and just finding new ways to not only get people to understand what you do and who you are, but also to purchase, right? To get them to the point of purchase.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about that process of finding the product market fit? What has been successful in your approach? And what are the different channels that you use now that maybe weren't available or you weren't using earlier on?
Yeah, I mean, product market fit's a bit of an illusory like kind of moment because it's always like a scaled, I think it more as like a, maybe like a more of a threshold function rather than an absolute sort of deterministic calculation. Because people who have it, they typically do notice it as an after the fact, but how I got there is a little bit opaque, right?
Yeah.
And so you get like, basically, I firmly believe in like link methodology, it works. The question is, do you have enough time to do it, right? And the goal is to make as many bets as possible so eventually you can hit a home run. So the goal is to have as many swings on to the pitcher so that you can basically hit it out of the park, right? Okay. And so people underestimate, like, just continuing the baseball analogy, a baseball player that has a batting average of over 300 makes $50 million a year, one of the highest paid athletes in the world. And that means he hits the ball 30% of the time. Great. And that's like, so there's even count like home runs and single and outs of the deal. Baseball is a highly mathematical sport, right? So you kind of have to think about it that way, which can be a slog. It's like, I don't really believe this. I don't really read business books from a perspective of like, I'm going to learn something about this. I read business books as if it's narrative, as I'm reading Harry Potter, right?
Yeah.
Because the lesson that actually they learned that they're trying to pass on to other entrepreneurs is a bit like contrite, because like, I'm not Peter Thiel. I'm not Mark Cuban. I'm not David Sachs. Right. I'm not Shamab. Like I'm not Jason, right? And we all have different backgrounds and strengths and actual capabilities in front of us. So I read business books as like kind of like, I'm interested in people. Yeah. And I'm reading a biography of Churchill. Yeah. It's the same as like reading a biography about some other famous investor or CEO. And so like, I'm trying to gather like principles and like rules of life and values. But like the, a lot of these times, like these people like find product market fit. It is something they kind of just found. It wasn't like, you know, like finding gold, it's finding treasure. Yeah. So you want to just increase the number of repetitions so you actually can achieve that and like create basically the number of times you're at bat. I'm trying to basically strike out as fast as possible. Because you strike out, you learn something. You learn something about the pitcher, what he's trying to do, the game that the other team is playing. And never underestimate grit, because grit is like real. And you just want to like be betting on the right things and like move fast. So I try to like bias towards more like successful pattern matching rather than like trying to overanalyze something, because you're not really at the stage when you're like at our stage of a company. Like analysis provides insight, but ultimately in the day, like it's a gut decision on what you want to do. As you reach like series B and C, the goal is to create a much more systemized approach about how you make decisions, because the founder can't make a decision everywhere. So you want to create metrics and rules and frameworks, because you're hiring people who are not founders. You're hiring people who don't have instinct and gut as strong as the founding team. So you have to create other systems in there. And this first part of the phase of a company is basically the success of the company is determined on the gut instinct of the founder and how fast they want to move on an instinct. Like that's actually going to be the determination. All those other stuff that comes into the play, like experimentation, data, are just really artifacts of justifying what is your decision about how to make a bet, right? Because there's not enough data to tell you what to do. Data doesn't actually tell you what to do. Analysis and human judgment is what actually makes the decision, right? Yeah. Numbers are numbers. Numbers have no agency. Like they're 4, 5, 55, 10.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't tell you what to do, right? It tells you what it is, right? And so don't underestimate the skill and the judgment of the founder to like hear what customers are saying, make a bet, try the bet, swing, struck out, maybe hit a single, right? Try that single, maybe hit a double, right? But most of these successful stories I have some friends that have found something, they feel very blessed because it is kind of like finding treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the orientation of how to be successful, how you can find treasure, is just creating as much data input so you can inform your judgment, but then also like creating multiple swings to where do a lightweight test. Don't be afraid of it being like embarrassing.
Yeah.
Like, because you should have enough value to the customer. Even if it is embarrassing, they don't really care. Because the point is like you're solving a problem big enough to where it's not fancy, right?
Yeah.
And if it feels more comfortable, push it even further. Just make it like literally sell features via email. Just like email a customer and be like, this thing doesn't exist yet, but I could build it. What do you think about it, right? Uh-huh. And then from there, you can actually start building roadmaps. So I always encourage like super early feedback, be fast, be slightly embarrassing, because you should solve a problem so severe enough that they don't really care, because they want the thing that bad.
And I think people often underestimate how much people want to be involved in the development of a project or a problem. They enjoy helping someone get to that next step. So it's like, like you said, it's like be a little embarrassing. Another way is just like extract your ego from the project. Think about what can improve the project versus how that project reflects on yourself as a founder. And changing that mentality is definitely important. Moving into HydroHost, what in particular inspired you to go in this direction? Being that the previous companies don't really have it's not like you were working with data centers previously, but what in particular was exciting about this problem that you're solving, and what do you believe is the potential after solving this problem?
Yeah, like the initial genesis was that having worked on very expensive infrastructure Yeah, because my focus on technology has always been application layer, so UX and JavaScript, React, Node. And I just kept encountering this problem of like infrastructure was a commodity, but it didn't behave as a commodity.
Yeah.
So it was basically like pre-deregulation of airlines, right? So you had all these travel agents, which are like Amazon and Azure, and they basically lock you in and they say, oh, but traveling is a commodity, but you actually have no choice, right? So that's like kind of like what happened with the idea of like it's the largest portion of spend at a technology company's infrastructure. And as like an individual, independent of people, it's the most highly business critical, and the innovation there has been really weak.
Yeah.
So originally we started with like, how do we make things cross cloud? And then we found that like, actually that's not going to be our views. Like that's like not going to be the future. The future is going to be hybrid, mainly because cloud itself was built under a bunch of assumptions that are actually not being true. They were true when it came about, which was like managing data centers were hard and buying metal was expensive and like networking was difficult and it was hard to run applications. Now there's like thousands of open source projects. Getting metal is the easiest than ever before. There are more data centers than ever before, right? So the idea of like a mega data center, right, is becoming less and less relevant, right? But what's becoming more relevant is edge, more relevant is bespoke metal, like GPUs, like high-performance computing, NVIDIA cards. And also you have the other thing regarding like the politics, the nature of how people want to live and work.
Yeah.
That has radically changed under the position of Amazon or AWS. AWS has created an environment where essentially America ran the internet, right? The definition of what is the internet was what America, and that was the only definition that existed. Now you have GDPR, you have different states that have different privacy laws. You have nations that are excluding access to different applications, like China with US companies. You have the probability is quite high that TikTok is going to be banned. So now technology is not just this, hey, it's fun. Look at all the stuff you can buy and like read weird blogs. It's actually now a national security issue, right? And so in that environment, the you say onshoring, the nationalization of infrastructure is very anti-cloud. And cloud itself, which is quite valuable for certain things, is not the answer to all things. And in an environment where like workloads being pushed out further and further, and that's only increasing as cell phones and TVs and home internet become stronger and stronger, the idea of centralizing compute in like five locations in the US makes less and less sense. Because you cannot get past fiber is the speed of light, like near speed of light, but like essentially speed of light. So like you can't get faster than that. So literally it's as fast as possible and the demands are only increasing, which means logically that you have to move, right?
Yeah.
You have to move to a different geo, right? You have to move to where there's data centers and east side of, there is, by the way, east side of LA, west side of LA, north side, south, right? All over the place, right? Not just to serve big Netflix or something like that, but to serve the local company that's doing some workload. Like things are becoming more and more wireless, right? Which means it's streams, which means that compute has to move closer to the customer because it's too slow to do live streaming to throw it all away in San Francisco if you're doing live streaming from LA, right?
Yeah.
Like these are all things that by the nature itself, public cloud is not optimized for. And it doesn't know how to really solve that problem. And if it solves a problem, it's super expensive. So small regionalized data centers that are like, you could say mini data center movement are becoming more and more popular. Because like these workloads are highly specific to the regionality that's needed. So whether that's for like performance reasons, security reasons, to like political concerns, whatever, like there's a huge unlock potential that exists within the 3,000 data centers all across America that are basically putting a lot of their work into public cloud or doing Windows as a service to like enterprise companies. That if you built out a bespoke sort of basically like Airbnb style network of like a data center that's attached to a nuclear power plant, right? That's basically free energy, right? And there is one. There's actually a couple in the world and nobody really knows that exists. But if you have the company, let's say REI or like some other green company, Greenpeace, whatever, like giving access to that to where they can run on that if they choose and that's a preference. Right now they can't do that. Like they have to spend months to try to go find these places and then set up and do provisioning and they got to do all this networking stuff. So what we do is work an easy button. We basically provide immediate access to bespoke data centers if you're doing ML workloads and AI workloads. So where you can go to these places that have specialized characteristics to where the homogenous public cloud is actually not really useful for. And the pricing difference in the scenario, right? This could be as big as like 50 to 60% cheaper and more performant. An increase in performance, like doubling to tripling in terms of performance But the reason why you can't get access to it, it's sort of like real estate that's like locked away. They didn't know existed. And so that's what we're trying to solve for, is that a company that is looking for access to a hybrid environment, data centers can do everything for you. And we're not saying that. But, you know, if you're running really complex workloads at the edge, the cloud makes almost no sense to do that in. And rather the hybrid model, which we believe should be the future, which is you use cloud to do certain things and you do data centers for certain things because it's more cost effective, it's cheaper, it's more secure. You know exactly where it is. You control your own cage. You control your own network access. That can make a lot of sense. And this is why every Fortune 100 company is hybrid cloud. They're not completely public cloud. They're hybrid because it doesn't make sense to give everything public cloud. Otherwise, you like bankrupt your company or you like have to fire people. A great post you should refer to is DHH, right? So he started their Ship Signals. He wrote over the last 3 months about his move from public cloud to data center. And he's written several. DHH is very opinionated about lots of things. And he's now saying like managing your own metal is cheaper and faster than ever before. And by doing that, he saved several people's jobs that he was going to have to let go. Wow. So he took a $4 million, $4 million bill down to less than $1 million a year, right? That's huge for a company. Like that's huge. And so I think that there is a sort of like zombie-like behavior with public cloud that is more of a zero interest rate or low interest rate phenomenon. When you have interest rates at 5%, venture capital is much more hard to get by. You have to be perform in a higher degree of paying out. This is why you see this shift to like cheaper infrastructure, because that is basically the most commoditized part of your business. It's like electricity. And why not pay for something that is cheaper, better, faster, more designed for you if you know exactly what your workloads are going to be?
And tell us a little bit about the traction. How many data centers are you working with? How many clients have you been able to bring onto a private cloud? Where's the company at now? And what in particular are you excited about in terms of the next phase of growth?
So this is one of the things that you have to learn, is that not everything is a React app that you can just throw into the cloud and it just works, right? So as a background as a software engineer and then can be a data analyst like that, like there's definitely a lot of things you take for granted and like how fast it is to do something. So we're like working at like levels that are, I didn't even know existed, right? So there was kind of like a learning curve very early in the company about like, what is networking in a data center, right? Because the internet, like what we're functioning on, is physically located into metal in the place, right? And that kind of like we underappreciate that as the expansion, even the fact of like the obsession over AI stuff, like those are built on like physical locations, and you just kind of I go in here and do this and done, right? Like all that magic that happens. So it's been a lot of lessons learned about like how fast it actually is to be able to build software that has to physically go a place, right? And because when you built a software company or I've built a software company before, you just put it in the cloud and it's dead, right? But this, like I literally have to move software from a place to another place and provision it in a physical location that I determine, right? And that's a very different set of problems than actually like just throwing it into the cloud. So that has been a humbling aspect of like going from prototype to production has been much harder than we thought, as with most companies. So we have a network of around a dozen or so like data center partners around the country. We're selling it right now as like a Shopify solution. So we're going to do a rollout and probably towards the end of this year. So we're basically following the Shopify federated model. So they basically implemented a single API, and checkout flow across multiple merchant websites, right? That was its value prop for years. And so when you go buy a random t-shirt from a vendor or order some candles from someone, they on their website, it was done via Shopify, right? It was like a better version of like WooCommerce, right? So we plan on rolling everything up through a universal API to where if you were like, I want to find a really cool NVIDIA machine that is located in a region I want that has standardized SOC 2 and ISO and GDPR compliant, that you can go to our single API and then you can find it, right? So that's like strategy this year. So we've been working on just data center implementations to build out the marketplace, to build out the inventory, the SKUs, and then we'll then do a rollup later this year where you can, as a company, through a single API, through a single programmatic interface, find thousands and thousands of different types of machines that you could use to solve particular workloads.
And whether it's external or internal, what do you view as some of the biggest risks for the company today?
Key, So the biggest risk, what is the, like, everybody in this moment is wondering about the economy now that affects like venture, right? So venture has gone through an existential crisis in the last year, and it's really unclear what's going to happen. Obviously the obsession over AI, we have a number of GPU providers. So like we're in the same like epoch. And so I would say like, that's probably the area that I think about the most, because it's a non sort of, what's the right word for it? It's a market risk. It's like independent of you being able to operate as a company. So like, I consider that like the economy is really uncertain, and the patterns of what you thought was like the threshold to justify your next valuation is now gone, right? Like nobody actually really knows these numbers. Like the numbers from like, I'm in all these like signal groups with different founders and VCs, like literally the numbers are crazy. Like they're all over the place. Like they're some of them are back to pre 2000-2001 level, interest rates were zero. Some of them are like assuming interest rate of like 5%, right? And so like, that's a very, when you're leading a company, it's pretty like scary, because you don't know what the response is going to be when you go out and fundraise. Before it was like, hit these metrics, hit these numbers, and then you'll make it. Right now, it's kind of like, I don't know, right? The mood is really bad. The second is with us, it's like, we're seeking to have a very clear horizon towards break even. So we're basically trying to build the company a little bit differently than we thought before. So we've done significant cost cutting back way last year. And so we went through that was the right word, medicine, much sooner than many other companies, because we saw the basically writing on the wall of what higher interest rates are going to do. So we basically preserved our runway, and we've been doing that really aggressively. And so with that, like there's a differently, when you go talk about building a company, a difference between surviving and growth. And sometimes that can be a hard way to figure out like what is actually, okay, we just need to do this to survive. So like, oh no, this is a growth opportunity we should bet on, right? So today, entrepreneurs are going through much more difficult time to try to figure out like how to actually do a strategy. When before it was like, oh, the good times, money was cheap. Like you just kind of like grew as fast as possible. And this is much more like a balancing game between actual running a business and running some fundamentals. Of course, you're still going to lose money because you're venture back, but like building out those fundamentals can still, for some investors, be like, oh, look, they actually thought about this. They cut costs, they like managed, they show discipline, they show thoughtfulness. And so the growth may be like, if you're growing at 2x a year, that actually may be amazing now, right? Before it was like 5x required, right? But the fact is you're able to manage, right, this situation. So like, that's like more of an operational concern. The third is then we want to basically move fast to break things, where it's harder to explain what types we're building and foundation elements we're building. Essentially, we're building new rails on networking to actually run this marketplace. And that's a very hard technical task to do that. And because there's a lot of assumptions about how infrastructure works, that just is because they use cloud. And what we're trying to build is like a new cloud that is essentially a new cloud that exists on new types of infrastructure, new types of frameworks, to where it is actually agnostic, to where Julian can go to our website and be like, I want to buy that data center. Oh, I want to move it now. That happens in milliseconds. Yeah. Like that's new types of pipes on the internet. And so that's a big task. And so we're settling for the fact of like, we're a different type of company. We're not going to be I make some random AI abstraction and then it grows really fast because someone's using it a lot, right? Because I'm not really a company. I'm just built on top of ChatGPT, right? So we're not that type of company. We're much more of like the bones of the internet and how the internet, like I actually build workloads on the internet. Like that's a very different type of company. And so I'm much more of like an Elon Musk type of entrepreneur. Not that I'm not even close to him, but like what he finds interesting, which is kind of like boring problems. That's what he would say. That's why he created the boring company. That's like how my mind works. So like, what is like the simple thing that if it was better would have massive impact in society, right? And so he took on problems that now we view as sexy, predominantly because it's Elon Musk and anything he touches is interesting. But like he took on pre-Tesla, electric cars were super boring.
Yeah.
It was free, right? Wow, who wants that? And he made it interesting. Spaceflight, right? He literally defunded NASA because he thought that this wasn't an interesting thing, right? He made it interesting again, right? So tunnels were not interesting, even though it's actually an immensely interesting problem to me, but I'm into like urban science and stuff. So, and then he's made it interesting, right? So that's kind of like how I think about products. To me, it's like, how does it impact the real world? I'm less interested in the like whatever fanciful thing that is the new in vogue, like venture capitalists like trying to justify the LPs why they keep paying the title fees, right? Like the there's so many things wrong with the assumptions behind AI from a basic economics perspective that it's kind of enlightening that a lot of the people that I thought were like amazing business people were maybe just into hype. And there's something real in AI. We provide GPUs to people. So even from a, just as a side point, I studied economics in college. Like if it takes less and less people to build value into a company, that means it's also more easily commoditizable, which means it's less and less defensible. Yeah. Like it's like basic economics people. So if it takes like somebody 2 weeks to build a competitor or something, that means that it also takes the larger company 2 weeks to do it. Like, what do we all, Paul Graham's advice, which was what? Do things that don't scale, right? Mm-hmm. It's like this weird thing that's going on in people with AI that a lot of things that people are building are like immensely, I mean, I use ChatGPT. I have my engineering team use ChatGPT. We use Autopilot, but those are features. Like a lot of things that are coming out in terms of obsession are features. Like, and it's also like, I've gone and tested some of the things that people have wrote these long Twitter threads about, millions and millions of views. And they don't work.
Yeah.
Like the things they're claiming it doesn't do, right? And so that is like massive, like, I just think there's so many VCs that are biting their hand. Maybe that's not the right phrase. Like they're falling for something. Yeah. I think mostly as a narrative to justify getting money in from LPs. Something exciting, interesting, something to cover for the fact that they paid 20 times in a Series D, right? Have a company that's worth half that now, right? They're trying to create some narrative shifts.
Yeah.
AI is valuable. Like don't worry, it is immensely valuable. It simplifies so many things in my life, but a lot of those things are features on something else. And Chamath had a great point on all-in, which was very underappreciated. But like if ChatGPT was really the next Google, why did they sell half of their business to a hosting company? Right. And it was such like a brilliant, subtle point of like returning to economics of like, there's probably something here you don't think is here. It doesn't mean it's not valuable. It doesn't mean it's not interesting. It doesn't mean you should not be invested in. But like, let's bring back to the reality that like you're the fact that you think you can make something that like I could pay someone on Fiverr for, like by computer is somewhat impressive, but I could have paid someone Fiverr for, right? Which would be those $5 of value, right? And there's I feel a little bit like I'm kind of crazy that I feel like the trajectory is going this direction. A bunch of things will be funded and will blow up and there are actually no value there. But there'll be a couple of things that really come out of this that I particularly think like this will break, I think, a lot of things in hosting. I actually really believe that because hosting, like as in cloud, is not really designed for these new workloads like edge computing and ML, AI, ETL companies, right? All these companies are hamstring predominantly because they built on the cloud versus like this is actually forcing people now to be like, I don't need your cloudy features. I don't need your Kubernetes. I don't need your SQL management. I don't need your serverless. I just need a NVIDIA machine that is freaking awesome that can do this, right? Yeah. That's all I need. And so I think it's breaking that down to where companies are looking outside because running GPUs in Amazon is freaking insanely expensive. Or there's a GPU cloud company, freaking crazy, like $200,000, $400,000 a year for like one machine, right? And I was selling machines for one of our new GPU providers. I was selling for like 60% less than that because data centers don't have all these needs. They don't like, if you're just getting directly from the data center, you're removing so many of the middlemen or travel agents, removing the tunnel of travel agents and a ton of the weaknesses that exist within these cloud operations that prohibit proper access to bare metal. Yeah. I think that's the, one of the good things is like, workloads are only becoming more complicated, more network dependent, and cloud is not good at those types of things. And so this will be a good breaking apart the high metering that goes into cloud. Cloud is like not actually cheap. It's like paying. Would you ever pay McKinsey to do a UX design for you? Of course not, right? But that's easily what you're doing in the cloud. Right. Is that you're outsourcing and you're paying a very high meter fee, not small. This isn't like the margins in cloud are like 30-40%, right? We're not talking about strength, which is like what, 2 points, 1 point, right? It's like huge, right?
Yeah.
And that value will erode over the course, I think, of this next decade as you see workloads push out further and further, where centralized computing doesn't make sense.
Yeah. If everything goes well, what's the long-term vision for HydroHost?
That we are the Shopify style alternative to Amazon AWS.
Yeah.
So you come to us when you want bare metal. You come to us when you want like SOC 2 highly compliant environments. You have like specific needs around regionalizing compute that like basically cloud can't do. That's what we want. So you want to be able to come single interface, single place where you can kayak request some specific route, like on an airplane, some specific route, and that you can get that in within milliseconds. That's what we want to build.
I love that. I always like to, I love this next section. I call it my founder FAQ. So I'm going to hit you with some rapid fire questions and we'll see where we get. First question, sure. I always like to open it up is, what's particularly hard about your job day to day?
Well, one of my Aaronisms, you could say, is that being a CEO, no one cares about how you feel, right? And I know every time I say that to another exec friend, they're like, yep, that's true, right?
Yeah.
And it just, I'm not complaining. I'm not bemoaning. That's the exact opposite. I love my job. I love my team. I love my co-founders. I'm very blessed to work on things I want to work on and have the agency I do. But that's just downside. Like being rational, being wise as a person means that every decision has a downside.
Yeah.
And be okay with that. And the downside is when you lead a company, you are the final bucks out to you and everyone brings their crap to you.
Yeah.
And you don't have the capability to share it out with other people because what's going to happen? They're going to be like, you're the boss. Why are you complaining to me? Right. So you just have to learn to be resilient and have like non-company friends and things like that.
Yeah.
Like best friends, like a camaraderie between, if you're a male, like a camaraderie between men that, you know, you can share like feelings with and things you're battling. And then that's one of the harder things of like, it's very easy to go on autopilot when you are running a company and that can only get you so far before you're burned out.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Thinking about your experience with running companies and also being a part of other companies and being in think tanks and things like that. And you mentioned it earlier about the fundamentals. Companies will be a little bit more, at least the successful companies during hard times, I think they just have that as a quality of theirs. What are those fundamentals for you and what will allow your company to kind of not only weather external just uncertainty as environments ebb and flow, but also kind of build the foundation so you can continue to scale on top of it? And scaling being that, add more resources, more team, more customers, it's more of everything. What are those fundamentals to you?
So it's a question like, what are the fundamentals of like the value? Like what would showcase at a company like more, show that they're successful?
Like, yeah, more so. Yeah. Like if it was a company was a machine and you looked at its components, what are the components it has that allow it to actually build on top of? Less philosophical, more mechanical.
Yeah. Mechanical?
Or tactical.
Well, actually, I would default to philosophical because I think that's actually what you can't really change in a company. I think the mechanical stuff is quite fungible. You can teach people new tools, but it's sort of like the saying of like you can't really change people in a company. Like you can't change your values. You can't change your personality. It's work, right? Work has meaning, but it doesn't change typically people existentially. It's actually a reflection of their existential values, typically. Obviously, there's exceptions. But the mechanical side would probably be around like the things that I would look for is the sales orientation. I think having a really good sales strategy tells people a lot about whether or not the company knows what it's doing and being like very clear on that. I think product related things as well would be second after that. Can they actually launch? Although if you have product market fit, like the best example of a bad product organization is Twitter.
Yeah.
Like Twitter has always been a mess. They've had more executives you can count and Elon proved that when he bought the company. So yet it's still a product market fit, right? So you actually do a lot of damage to your company, even if you have product market fit and no one goes anywhere, right? So, but product itself is a really good sign. Like how fast do you ship? How do you develop tickets? How do you develop your strategy around that? The leadership around that. And let's see if we can give a third. Like a third would probably be like maybe their ability to pivot into some different area. Like how fast can they actually cohesively as a company like adopt new ideas and like do something about it?
Yeah.
But I think sales, the tip of the spear stuff in a company is really insightful because it really tells you what they want to do and how they talk about themselves and what's their actual value.
Yeah. I know you mentioned some resources earlier, but I always like to ask this question because I love how founders extract knowledge out of anything that they ingest. Whether it's early in your career or even now, what books or people just continue to impact you and how have they been impactful for you?
Sure. So my top list is the Bible. So I'm a late stage Christian and The Bible has taught me so much about humanity, life, everything from how to love people, how to have a good life, and how to be a good executive. So by far, like my Christian faith in the Bible, there's a reason why it's the best-selling book of all time and has like never been updated, right? So we should humble ourselves and not have chronological snobbery and say that like there's a reason why these things exist and you're not the smartest person in the world, right? So the humility aspect of, I think, being a leader is really, really critical to actually improving your team and also impacting the world. Like if you come with this arrogant perspective that like it's all up to me, you're really going to ignore countless wisdom that is true regardless of the age it is. Like forgiveness, which is key to Christianity and grace, is true today as it was back then. Because humans, from a behavioral perspective, from a pathology perspective, are the same. And you can go literally read like raw letters from people in Roman times. They're dealing with the same stuff we deal with today. What am I going to do with my life? What am I supposed to go? Like, what is meaning? What is purpose? Like, same thing as we are today. Like, so take that, like, that metaphysical approach to your life, because you'll just be a better leader, you'll build better companies, you'll impact people to such a significant positive degree that it changes their life. It's great. But the second would be actually the kind of not, as I told you before, like, I don't really need many business books because unless I'm going to like do a biography, right? Then I'll read it. But like history, particularly economic history, is immensely fascinating for like how to build a company and how to like think about problems. And because fundamentally as a company, you're trying to solve a societal problem. So there's kind of a, to use a Greek word, politique means way to live. Companies are impacting that. And so if you read like economic history, whether it's about Leninism to mercantilism to histories of republics and kingdoms, it tells you a lot about like how people try to solve problems and how they think about things. So I think there's like I typically read biographies by historical figures. Like I've read one recently about Mao and about Lenin and about Churchill. I've read one about Washington and Jefferson. So like these really prominent figures are like really impactful to the way I think about how people solve problems. But the third would be like philosophers. And I read a ton of people I don't even agree with because that's not the point. So like, for example, like there's John Rawls is probably one of the most important philosophers. I don't agree with what he says, but he's the most important philosophers of our generation.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that you have said things that he has written that you thought was your own idea. Yeah. And people like that are immensely powerful to understanding marketing, understanding how to build a product, understand like where things are going to go.
Yeah.
And Rawls, another one's I call Popper, a later one would be kind of the early French Renaissance people, Enlightenment people, and early mathematicians like Merton. He's another great one. Like all these people have created these, what I call echoes in culture that have a way of feeding into what people want and what they desire and what they're trying to do. And if you don't kind of know those trends, it's hard to distinguish about why certain things won and why things certain things don't.
Yeah.
And I think that as a founder, you have to be quite objective and look at things from the perspective of like, I may not want this. Right? I may not want this company to exist. I may not want this product to exist. But like there are trends in human beings, because ultimately we're building companies to serve humans that you can't defeat, right? Yeah. You can build something that could maybe move this way, but you gotta like understand that there are dialectics, to use a Hegelian phrase, that you are in that is going to perpetuate a certain type of way of thinking into the future. So if you look at like one of the best examples in our economic activity startups is Balaji. So he is a very skilled person in philosophy, and everything he's saying is connected to what he believes the metaphysics of the world are going to. And that's a very valid way of building a company, to knowing the vision, knowing what tomorrow is going to be like. And so like, it's not that like necessarily like if I read some Popper. And so he's basically a kind of, I believe, like anti-scientistic guy. So like he basically created this like relativistic framework for truth and things like that, yada, yada, yada. So Popper basically tells me the way a lot of people like kind of manage people who think that way, to kind of like pull out ideas from him that could be impacting culture. Doesn't mean it's like impacting like what I'm going to put in the next room, right? But like as a leader of a company, you have to like know these things, because if you're successful, you're going to be managing thousands of people.
Yeah.
And they're not going to know you, but you have to build a system in a company to manage the narrative that's external to what you're trying to build and the profit and the value you're trying to create in your company.
Yeah. Yeah. I love asking this question because I like to make sure we didn't leave anything on the table. I know we're coming to the end of the show, but is there any question I didn't ask you that I should have, or is there anything we didn't bring up that you want to chat about last little bit before we give you time to give us your plugs, your LinkedIns and stuff like that? But real quick, yeah, anything we left on the table here today?
I would say, what is the most heterodox view I have of technology right now? And it's that I'm a bear on AI. So that may haunt me in the future. I don't really care. I've been wrong about lots of things and I'm still right about most things. So I'm a bit of a bear on, the ability to build a company in the space. Yeah. I'm very bullish on its usage and utilization. And I haven't done an interview yet since I came to that conclusion.
Yeah.
So that would be the thing. So I'm not on the rage train right now. Yeah, I use AI every day, but I think it's hard to see independent enterprise value being created apart from existing platforms. I think it's difficult for me to see that.
Yeah. I'm somewhat in the same camp, but maybe we'll have another conversation about that at a later time.
But
Aaron, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show and learning not only from your early career, but how you kind of think about startups, think about building companies and what you're able to do in terms of adding, like you said, almost just new edge of infrastructure on something that's been highly regular and highly popularized, which is cloud, and really thinking about it, at least from a builder's perspective, to access those resources and those tools in a different way that obviously benefits you monetarily, but also with speed and all these different things. So excited to see where you're going to go with this company and where you're going to take it. But last little bit is, where can we find you? Where can we support? Give us your plugs, your LinkedIns, your Twitters, your blogs, wherever we can find you to be a fan and support.
Yeah. So Hydra is hydrahost.com. Yeah. So EC, I have a pretty active Twitter personality profile. So that's AGINNT. And I also have a Substack that's AGN and Substack, where I write about philosophy, business, and culture, more of like an expression of my, let's say, non-business interests. Yeah. And used to be active on Medium until I got canceled. So now it's on a Substack.
I love that, man. I love that. And thank you so much for being on the show. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I'm so excited to share this with the audience. But again, it's been a pleasure chatting with you today.
Yeah, absolutely.